cheers.
Cheers.
All right. We're kind of late on that cheers.
Yeah, I know. Right. I thought I had to burp.
Oh,
I was pre-gaming with some Heinekens.
Ah, okay.
Because apparently now James Bond drinks Heinekens. And
what?
You know, I have to too.
No, he doesn't.
The Skyfall thing. Have you even seen the advertising campaigns? I've been totally flabbergasted by this whole thing of like...
No, James Bond
vodka didn't. Martini, shaken, not stirred. That's James Bond, right?
He never drank a Heineken.
No, but apparently...
I saw the movie. He didn't drink a Heineken.
In the whole movie? That was my whole, like, I'm holding up because I'm seeing these commercials and I'm seeing Heineken at the liquor store and there's James Bond Skyfall on Heineken.
No, you don't. No.
What? What?
No.
Yeah, James Bond doesn't even drink beer.
No.
And if he did, he probably, I mean, unless the movie like took place in Holland or something.
And if he did, it would be Dos Equis.
Or something. He'd be hanging out with that dude with the, you know, stay thirsty, my friend. Yeah, it would be his like grandfather or something. Yeah. You know.
He never drank a Heineken through the whole movie.
Well, then. How did Heineken get rights to James Bond?
Yeah, who knows?
So we should cheers again and just say, hey, to James Bond not
keeping it real.
Keeping it real.
Yeah.
Fucking vodka martini. Because it is RPG Afterglow.
Yeah.
And the nerd rant apparently is running hot. Because the dice get rolled, the story gets told, and we ponder the significance.
Yeah.
And we are pondering session 23. It is the Michael Jordan session of our Cosmopolitaniana campaign.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Gosh, and it was a good one.
23 sessions then. Actually.
There are 52 weeks in a year.
Yeah.
So half of that, we are approaching the halfway mark of a year playing through this whole campaign, which is not insignificant, I would like to say.
No.
If we can give a little insight into what led into this particular session...
Well, we chased off the Black Dragon.
Yes. We had our first big encounter with a formidable dragon.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of where we left off.
And then we gathered ourselves up and Violet got off the roof of the gazebo. We realized that the floor of the gazebo, the inside of the floor, was actually an illusion.
Yeah, the floor was always suspect because no one was really confident enough to, like, go in there.
Yeah.
And there was that bowl of fire in the middle that seemed to be the catalyst of the illusion. Before we got to really poke and prod that thing, the dragon came in, and that's when the combat ensued.
Right.
But now the dragon was... The dragon had been driven away.
Yeah. Droven away. Yeah.
And we were left with the tempting thought of, well, there was a dragon.
Yeah.
And where there was a dragon, there must be treasure to plunder.
And there was.
And all eyes went to Taro, where it was like, Taro, you're good at tracking things. Track where this dragon might have its domain. But in... typical fashion, Violet having all the answers, her eyes were still on that floor that was perhaps illusionary.
And I found that it was dug out in the inside there. And
once you got past that illusionary level.
Yeah, it was dug out at an angle and they went down to a large underground room. And we went down there and it was littered with...
mountains of dirty treasure.
Dirty treasure.
As Wolfie explained it.
Yep.
And it was... very well organized, because it's nice when you get a break in your sessions that not only help out the story, telling suspense and momentum of you as players, but it also helps out your DM.
Mm-hmm.
And having my experience as being a DM, I've started to recognize that of like, hey, this would be a great time to stop because you want to get into this whole treasure thing and I have no idea what I'm going to give you. So let's give it a week so I can spend the week preparing.
Yeah.
Sort of a deal. And so that definitely shone through because we start the session and Wolfie's like raring to go.
Yep.
And he's got 20,000 copper pieces sitting around. He's got 20,000 silver pieces sitting around in these dirty mountains of treasure. He's got about 5,000 gold pieces and there's 500 platinum pieces. And, you know, he did require us to kind of spend a day sorting through all this stuff. And it wasn't just coins. Believe you me, no.
No.
It was also a good share of magical items and a good share of just really valuable items that he went one by one. And
the only thing I remember that when I got down there, I was detecting magic.
Yeah.
And so they was able to find many different magical items.
Yeah. Because after the coins, you went down there, did your detect magic, and suddenly a lot of things started glowing for you.
Yeah.
A spear a small spear.
Yeah.
Because someone
just lost their spear.
Just suddenly had their spear burnt up from this magical beam thing last session. Yeah. But this is a plus three spear.
Yeah.
Small sized for a gnome.
Yeah.
Of returning.
Yes. So if I were through it, I'm going to come back to me. That's good.
Just like the hammer of Thor.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And then there was a wand.
Yeah. The wand was Helping Hand. I mean, Helping Hand is it's an interesting spell.
Is that like something that gives you a massage when you're feeling tense?
No. Helping Hand is that you send out it's a hand to a particular kind of thing or like a person or particular thing like that. But I don't think it's so particular like this person. But let's say you're looking for a wizard or let's say you're looking for a cleric or let's say you're looking for maybe a carriage or something. It goes out and it beckons the person to follow it. And then
So it's like a little like hey,
yeah,
like a floating hand.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a Pepe Le Pew.
Yep.
Floating like scent trail.
You're exactly
the opposite.
Yeah,
and, you know,
and the whole thing is,
but it doesn't make any noise. It's just like, hey, you come here. But doing it with his hand.
Yeah. And if they ignore it, then it goes to the next closest candidate, you know, like, hey, okay, fine, you come here.
It goes to its dog and like mimics the biscuit.
So it would be like, you know, we're looking for a cleric and we'd go to that cleric. And if a cleric doesn't follow it, it would go to another cleric and maybe that cleric will follow it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool because, I mean, I'm sitting here rapidly trying to keep up with, because when Wolfie is like, here's your treasure, it's a spread of treasure, and it's rare.
Right.
And I'm sitting there like, my pencil is smoking.
Yeah.
I can't keep up.
So we
get the spear, we get the wand, and there is a scroll that I just wrote Tobias's concern. Because, I mean, he took it and I'm like, all right, fuck that guy. He's going to figure it out.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't even know. Were you paying attention to that?
No.
A scroll for Tobias.
A scroll for Tobias, yeah.
He's got it. He cares. But then there was also a composite longbow.
Yeah.
That had a plus two strength capacity.
Yeah.
Which initially I'm like, is this for me? Because I could take this if I enlarge myself and I give myself the strength mutagen.
Yeah.
But it's like, all right, after two rounds, I could use this, but it's like, I could still do better damage with my bombs.
Yeah.
And as I'm doing this whole like inner thought within like 5 or 6 or 10 seconds, Magnus is like, I'll take it.
Yeah.
So I'm like, all right, that probably makes sense because guess what? You're totally focused for melee. And we've seen you be totally paralyzed, like with that shadow demon thing.
Yeah.
Where our big fighter needs a ranged weapon.
Right.
Even though the fighter probably can't use the ranged weapon all that well because their dex isn't that great, it's still worth you having one.
Yes.
And then there was a light crossbow that was also small.
That was damaged.
It was damaged. Yep. But it was a plus three.
Yep.
You know, we are 8th level characters or 7th level characters, and that's still pretty badass, but still.
And
it was pretty clever, I think, that it was damaged.
Right.
That, like, this was something still worth holding on to fix.
Right.
And it came with a good share of bolts. There's also some potions.
Yep.
A couple of potions of water breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And a cure serious wounds potion, because if you're anticipating water, obviously, but who knows? But no matter what you're doing as a DM, it's always good to throw your party a good old-fashioned strong healing potion.
And then there was also some chainmail. I had to convince Magnus to use the chainmail.
There was a certain level of unexpected pride.
Yeah.
I mean, we saw the pride with the weapon and the axe that Magnus had used to kill his father that had murdered his mother. And there's this whole backstory about why this axe is sentimental. But your crappy-ass armor? I mean, look at this. If you're running a marathon, no, I'd rather wear sandals. No, here's some Nikes. They got air 25 PSI in the heels. It'll help you support your, like, calves and you won't get, like, shin splints. Just, like, wear these awesome shoes. No, I'll wear sandals.
Yeah, yeah.
No, Magnus, seriously.
So
you need this chainmail.
So Violet convinced Magnus that wearing this chainmail is like it. She said, you're a hero now. You should wear the appropriate chainmail.
The stakes are higher.
Yeah. And so and letting her know that it was magical and that it probably had more interesting effects
than just protecting you from harm.
Yeah. And so there were some hints that the chainmail sort of looked like scales. So we tried it out. And, of course, it gave her a swim speed, I do believe.
Yeah, we were still in this gazebo realm mm-hmm. where there was plenty of water around to try swimming.
Yeah.
And I guess it kind of paid off that I was always the dipshit that jumped into the water and Magnus always had to jump in after me.
Yeah.
Hey, look, this might happen again. At least it might help that you are good at swimming yeah. with armor.
Yeah.
As Magnus jumped in, there's a freedom of movement
yeah.
within swimming
yeah.
with this armor.
So there's like a swim speed.
Yeah.
So
without swim checks.
Right. Right. So that's always good.
Yeah. Which is kind of strange because, like, you know, God bless the Maker Girls. But at the same time, it's like a typical gamer would be like, here's an armor that protects you better. Okay, I'll take it. Here's an armor that protects you better. No, but here's an ability. Oh, okay, fine. You have to give them an incentive that's more than just it protects you better.
Yeah.
Like it makes you sparkle or it makes you like the flavor grape better. Oh, all right. I love grape, but now I like it better. Awesome. You know, it's just like, all right, well, know your audience, which so. I think is kind of admirable because yeah. it lends flavor to their, I mean, it's, it beckons to their adherence to the flavor of their character.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then so, beyond that, we just got to the point of just like finding really pretty treasure.
Right.
And it was very specific, but I don't, you know, we'll let you know if it matters later on.
Right.
But it was like things like a silver necklace with emeralds or a pearl earrings with diamonds. Yeah. You know, Wolfie was very specific, but it's like, we'll just take them back and hopefully get valuable gold in the end.
Yeah.
But, you know,
yeah.
who knows? Maybe because we're talking shit about them, it'll bite us in the ass because it's like, there's six great things that I put a lot of detail in. Well, it's just how much gold is it worth?
Well, you know, but the whole thing is when you're shaking the treasure, there's always that random chance that you're going to get art pieces or a jewelry. I'm sure he was doing the random rolls and that was on there. So it's like there was like 10 or like 5 interesting pieces of jewelry, which is kind of nice because it gives a little bit of flavor to the whole treasure instead of just like, it's okay. You found 500 gold pieces, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, so, I mean, I do
is
like.
Is there a certain history or an artifact or an artisan connected potentially to each one of these items?
Maybe, maybe not. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. Who knows? Or, you know, it might just be that it's treasure that we got to pawn off. But
yeah.
But it's.
Well, because that's like, as far as from like the DM point of view and the whole aspect of treasure, it's like, my assumption is that players will be like, oh, there's treasure. How much gold is it worth?
Yeah.
So that we can turn it into valuables that we can turn into our own ends.
Right.
But I'm like, no, it's a necklace that has a history that was made by this artisan back from this age that could inform this particular town that lends itself to this thing that you're trying to find out about. And it's like this whole aspect, you know, trying to use treasure to inform the history of something
right.
might
yeah.
be kind of like.
Interesting.
It could be. But do your players care?
Well, you know, the whole thing is my care. If I kept on giving, interesting treasure and the characters kept like ignoring it. Knowing me, I'd be like, well, I'm going to give something that would maybe, you know, they find these earrings and they hawk them. And then they find that they're being haunted by a ghost who wanted those earrings back. And then they have to spend time to find them. Hey, that's me. Yeah. I like doing things like
that. Well, and that's kind of where, that's why I'm asking. Because I'm the apprentice and you're the master in this table dynamic because you've had far more experience in this. And it's like, in my preparations and as I'm kind of looking forward to my next time to be a DM, and I'm like, even like looking at this list of like 5-6 different treasure things, and I'm like, why did he put that much detail into it? And I'm kind of thinking about it more. And I'm like, well, he could do this, that, and the other thing. But I'm like, would the players care? How would you stand up for that concern or that priority?
Well, I think Wolfie sort of enjoys taking it. Because when you roll it up, it goes, piece of artwork worth this much. And you're like, okay, so you can.
But that's kind of cold and boring.
Well, no, it's this piece of, but then it's up to the DM to go, okay, this is what it is. It gives you some examples of what you think that piece of treasure is going to be.
Yeah.
But then you can make up your whole thing too. You know, where I've done like little, that it's a miniature, you know, it's maybe 2 or 3 gold miniatures of certain things, you know, or like that, or, but it's not a magical piece, but it's interesting, you know? So, I mean, like these earrings and the necklace, they're interesting. They're like interesting treasure. Cause it's like, like, you're right. Most of the time people will look at it and it's just like, well, how can we hawk it and just get the gold?
Yeah.
But what if in your process of hawking it, you realize that it's actually like something that is very, very valuable to a particular NPC, or it is something that has, you know, a ghost that wants it back desperately, or all of a sudden that particular piece of treasures that you've always just ignored and hawked out, all of a sudden one of them going through your fingertips was all of a sudden, wait a minute, this was actually important. The next time you're like, look at them a little bit more carefully. Maybe it has something to tell you.
What tips the scales for you as a DM as to when to deploy that sort of a tactic? Because sometimes if the story's going on in a solid direction and they are totally disrespecting these awesome treasure that you put work into, or at least that you've like put detail into.
I think I would do it like maybe after a couple of different treasures, and they, you know, and they kept that. I think until someone goes, it's just another stupid earring or another six. And that would always kind of, I would get, you know, how Woofy likes to smile and blink. That kind of like piques my ear a little bit. I'm like, oh, okay. I remember that, you know, it's just, I don't know, because it is kind of fun to, when all of a sudden people are just, they make assumptions, that's the best time to get sort of surprise them. You're doing all these assumptions, but maybe you shouldn't be.
That time a few weeks back that we had missed some, and it was right at the point where we had come upon all those evil artifacts.
Yes.
Like that dagger of cold, stabbing, death drain, whatever it was. Tobias was just like, nah, we'll sell it.
What?
You know, our realm of power is just in the gnomes, but what you were saying right there was kind of like, if I was the DM and Tobias did that once, it's like, all right. What?
Yeah.
Okay. But then, you know, I give him another evil-oriented necromancy sort of a thing, and he sells it off again. I'm like, yeah, okay, you got one more strike, or maybe I'm going to do, you know, like, that would be a point to deploy it.
I would almost at that point go, okay, time for a lesson.
Yeah. Right.
But just kind of think of the best, you know, the best stories. The best stories are always that kind of way where the hero makes assumptions. And they're just, you know, it's just life as always. And then all of a sudden, you know, aliens grab them or something like that. You know, that makes the best stories.
I don't know. That reminds me of Thor, the Marvel Avengers movie, where Thor is just like, I am going to be king in the first 15 minutes of this film. And you're going to go home being reassured that you spent $15 to get into this movie to see me be king.
Yeah.
And it's awesome. And then Anthony Hopkins like, nope, you are a cocky son of a bitch. That's the main turn of events for the film happens. But I guess the reason why, you know, I was asking you initially of when do you decide to deploy that sort of a mechanism, because that's kind of a thing for one character more often than not. You know what I mean? Like, that would be a great thing if, like, you're the DM and Thor is your PC, but then you've got all this, the rest of the party. I suppose something with this treasure, it's like everybody's collectively deciding this.
Right.
Like, I guess in our party dynamic, it's Tobias going, nope, we're going to sell this stuff. And maybe you and I, Violet and Boddington, would be like, no, it's pretty.
Right. I would almost be thinking about it off the top, because what I'm seeing now is like you can see, you know, Steve, and you can see Magnus, and, you know, and you can see Megan and Nicole, and they're not necessarily interested in those pieces.
Like for their specific beauty.
Right. Just to see the traits of how the players play. And it's like, okay, I noticed that you tend to ignore these elements in the treasure, or they don't mean anything to you until we sell them. Well, this would be a clever thing to apply into my world, that maybe there's going to be a piece of treasure that's going to come up, and it's going to be unassuming that it has any purpose, because it has no magical aura to it. But because of the fact it's a valuable piece, it does have a connection to something.
Now, would you give any sort of hint?
Maybe.
There's also that turn where it's like, we've gotten 8 pieces of pretty and well-described treasure that have just ended up being a value of gold. But then all of a sudden, the 9th one you throw at us, that's the one that has a consequence?
Well,
like, what? Huh? That's not fair.
Well, how about just the fact that, you know, that you can use those pieces of treasures, maybe one of those pieces of those earrings or the necklace is the proper boon to give to an NPC that you've already known. That's also something that could be very, you know, that you could use.
Yeah.
That it's like, that's the perfect boon. And then they give you something back.
Yeah. Kind of in the uber affordable and relatively simplistic sense of, Lavender Lil for my adventure path. That was Floyd's fancy.
Yeah.
Is this girl that was a tiefling that just really loved lavenders. and just flowers in general. So you visited her, and, you know, it's one of these, like, things that you could just, you know, it's not like you're going to come upon a dungeon and find a bunch of lavenders and sell them off for a bunch of gold, but it was like, whenever there was that object, it was like, it was more valuable because it was portrayed to you as a PC from your dungeon master to go to this end rather than just the neutral, mundane gold piece end.
Moving on.
Yeah, so we raided the fucking,
we raided the dragon's den. And we collected all the gold and we moved on to the next tower.
Yes, because for as much time as we've spent talking about it and as much time as we spent delving through his den, it was always this sense of paranoia of like, he could be back any moment. I don't know. Like, how long is he going to be here?
Yeah.
For the sake of forward momentum on one side, and also for the sake of just, that's perhaps how it might have panned out, that we get far enough to the other tower that we hear a far off cry from that black dragon.
Yeah.
Kind of like after Bilbo snatches the ring and you hear, Precious is lost! You know, just like Smeagol losing his shit because he realizes that someone just totally raided his stuff.
Right. That kind of felt bad for the dragon.
But he did try to kill us. And he did start the fight. He did lure us in.
Yeah, he bested us.
If he was a victim, it would have been us trying to loot his stuff. But we're just trying to get to this tower.
But I wonder if Violet kind of thinks maybe she can make the dragon her friend.
You have enough projects for right now.
We're good, though.
A dragon is not one that you're going to change anytime soon.
But Violet thinks maybe she could do it. I don't know.
It's like, I have this vampire, and if I can just get it to drink cranberry juice, we could be friends. It'd just be, just satiate the vampire on cranberry juice.
The more someone hates Violet, the more she wants them to be her friend. I don't know. It's very weird.
Unless they're in your party.
Yeah, yeah. So, we came to the other tower, and the other tower was surrounded by a
not very, a wall of inanimate objects.
No.
But a very prickly bush.
A very thick hedge that went all the way around that was full of thorns. So, to get through it, I had a potion of
gaseous form.
I allowed Magnus and
Tobias
to drink it using your mutagen.
Well, it was my mutagen of alchemical allocation.
Yeah.
Which I might have mentioned before, but it's basically like you drink that and then you drink the potion.
Yeah.
But you don't swallow it.
Yeah.
You just spit it back out like Listerine. You get the benefits and the potion remains intact. Sure, it's a little grody because you got some backwash in there, but you retain the potion because you had this alchemical allocation thing going on. And that's a second level extract for me. And so I've had, I think, four of those. So I've been in the habit of using like three of them just to be alchemical allocation.
Yeah.
And just boost up my number of potions I have in my wagon to increase the diversity. You know, it's that whole trick of like, all right, I have all these different extracts to try to prepare, but which ones will be relevant? I don't know. And the alchemical allocation, sure, it costs you an extra round if it's in combat to be able to, like, utilize it, but it still allows you that diversity without having to expend your precious, expensive potions. So here, we all need gaseous form. Sure. We're all spitting it out, and, you know, by the time it gets to the third person, they're like, ugh, you know, looking at it like, really? I'm like, no, you don't have to drink it, just spit it out again.
But gaseous form, well, isn't it that the first person can spit it out, but then the second person has to actually drink the potion?
Each time you utilize the extract, it can only be used once. But if I utilize another extract, you know, in the same sense that I can have four second level extracts, I can memorize alchemical allocation four times and I could use it on the same potion four times. I just have to consume that extract four different times, each one separately.
So they were gaseous form and were able to easily pass through the hedge.
Yep.
I just flew over it.
Because you can.
Yeah. I casted fly and I flew over it and,
I rode with George.
Yeah. You rode with George.
And we just fast forwarded through that one.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I think that's all Wolfie was looking for was like that this was just going to be a barrier and not to be a knightly.
Yeah. Cause that is a delicate balance. Mm-hmm. Cause on the story end, it's like people will defend their shit.
Yeah. But it was a good defense.
Yeah.
It's a good fence.
And it took up a reasonable amount of time,
right.
I thought.
Then we came to the tower. Both Tobias and Magnus were in gaseous form, so they could actually slip right through the door as well.
Big front doors.
But we were stuck at the doors.
And you sensed a big magical aura
But I did really poorly on this roll, so I couldn't identify what it was.
Right. But you knew that, like, up higher up on the the tower, it was like some magical shit's going on.
Well, I mean, Taro and George tried to fly above it, but they were stuck. And they couldn't get past, like...
Much in the same sense that we were trying to climb up the stairs on the first one. And it was like, they're just kind of caught in this loop.
Yep.
And Taro and George are just kind of caught in this loop, flying, and they ascend, and then they ascend, and they ascend, and they're still maintaining the same altitude.
Right. So we realized we had to go through the door. Tobias came back through the door and to be on the other side with us before the spell expired. But Magnus hung out, and the spell expired, and Magnus was on the inside.
And he saw a crazy contraption in the middle of this tower. But we didn't. And he also saw murals on the wall.
Yep.
But we didn't. And he also saw kind of a hole through the top of the ceiling that went up through the other layers.
Yep.
Up through the other levels.
All the way up to the top.
To the top. But we didn't either. And at the very top, there was a glint of gold.
Yep.
That we also weren't there to see. But
we were all on the other side. And did you deactivate a spell or a trap?
On the door?
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't that the door that was held down by the bar?
It was, yeah. So you didn't have to deactivate anything from that side, correct?
No, that was just one that was just like held down by this beam that was very light to Magnus as he lifted it up from the inside.
But it was a heavy
assuming bar. It was designed for one to secure the door from the inside as if you lived there and you were the one that made it. But then once Magnus set it down like on the wall next to the door, it was like...
Yeah.
It was like super heavy. But regardless, there was no lock to pick. There was no trap to dispel. The doors opened up and we were able to follow in.
So, and then we went inside and we saw all these things as well. We saw that there were stairs going up and stairs going down. Violet had an interest.
Because it was a tower and it was circular.
Yeah.
So there was these staircases going along kind of the outer perimeter.
Yeah. Violet had an interest for going. Oh, and inside the pool, there was that whole cosmic map of the universe.
And that theme of the four brothers and sisters.
That's what the murals were about.
Still going on.
And the murals went in a pattern where they were working with the weave of magic. And at first, the four of them were doing friendly, interesting things with the weave of magic. But as the murals continued to move forward, the two guys were starting to do darker, deeper things with the magic.
Right.
And sort of more evilish things. So that was sort of
another tragic tale of these duo of duos.
Yeah. Which just made Violet really wish she would have touched a finger of the stone golem.
Why?
Well, maybe she could have talked to it. She wanted to be friends with the stone golem thing too in the bed. Yeah.
I still get guff for talking to Xtephorus.
I really didn't hate Xtephorus either. I just don't think he should have
given. You thought he was an idiot douchebag who was obsessed with nothing but
He is an idiot douchebag who is obsessed with nothing besides his own, just developing followers in his own world. He didn't care at all about these things that were trapped in
How are you sympathizing with me, sympathizing with him?
Well, the fact that I didn't really consider him a threat or anything, I wasn't really worried about him, but it was just, you gave him the star power.
I didn't know.
Yeah, I know.
You're so smart, Violet.
But it was a good shot. Maybe he could have done something for us, but it was just not the right guy.
Yeah, I guess I kind of blame myself for that.
I might have given him the star power too.
I'm like, well, it could, nope, he is a douchebag.
Yeah, he is a douchebag.
I don't disagree with you now.
So we went upstairs, although Violet really thought we should have went downstairs. And she was kept on discussing that with everyone as we went to the second level.
Well, mainly Tobias.
No, actually, no. I was talking to Taro, and I was talking to Magnus, and I think even you. That I really think
no, we should have been. I mean, I will stand by the fact that I adhere to this role-playing perspective since we've gotten to these islands.
Oh, that
whenever you're like, you know what? I think we might want to do this.
Yeah.
I will be the first one to go, you know what? I agree.
But anyways, I was going through that again going, you know what? I think, but Tobias is like, we're going up. And so he walked forward and fell right through a trap. That took him all the way down to the basement.
The trap fell out from the floor he was walking up.
We were on the second level.
Fell through the floor that we were at.
The main level.
Yeah. Came upon and fell farther down into the basement.
Yep.
I had a lot of fun just role-playing that up and looking over to Violet and being like, I didn't know you could do that. that was awesome, but that was still kind of mean. Like, did you really have to do that? I was totally convinced that because Tobias disagreed with you and because it lined up that he said, nope, we're going upstairs. You want to go downstairs, but we're going upstairs. And he takes 3 steps up the stairs and falls down 3 stories. I was convinced that that was some sort of spell that Violet did to be like, you know what? Nope. We're going downstairs, and you'll be the one to lead us there.
But Violet jumped through the trap after him because she has feather fall, but she only was able to feather fall to the main level before the trap shut. So she was stuck on the main level, and so she started wanting to go down to the basement, but she waited for you guys to come from the second level down. And then Tobias, in the basement, landed on a skeleton and sort of crushed it.
Which, you know, is something that perhaps a cleric is able to cope with.
Yeah. Took some damage, though.
Yeah, he did take some damage from the fall.
Mm-hmm.
But then we hear another scream that couldn't have been caused by a fall.
No. He came face to face with a very a grim spider.
Large
spider with like a swarm of spiders crawling all over it.
It was like a swarm generating spider.
Yeah.
That never, I was kind of surprised that like Wolfie never whipped out the swarm tokens. Like I thought, here's this spider that takes up a 10x10 space, but then here's like, it unleashes these swarms.
Well, I was kind of wondering if maybe the swarm hung out with that big spider and it wouldn't leave.
It was all within that same space.
Yeah, maybe.
That certainly simplifies things.
Yeah.
But he screams and suffers a bunch of damage and we all decide to...
Because it got sort of gutted by these pinchers that the spider has.
Yeah.
So we rushed down there, but it was going to take 3 rounds. And in that 3 rounds, he succumbed to poison.
It was a strength drain.
Yeah, it wasn't doing that hot. But we got down there, and Magnus getting in there and hacking and slashing.
He takes it out.
But he took a lot of damage, too. It was doing, like, 33 to Magnus.
But I still think it's just, like, kind of hilarious that, sure, this is a trap set by the DM that a player will fall into and suffer a bunch of damage for being foolhardy and not recognizing the trap and this, that, and the other thing. But just the fact that it was, like, immediately foreshadowed by our oftentimes ignored sorceress. That's just like, you know what? We should go downstairs. Nope, we're going upstairs. I'm Tobias. We're going upstairs.
You know what was funny?
And then it all happens and it all unfolds and all the, the dungeon shit happens because of that.
You know, and what was funny was is that trap, both Tobias and Violet were on that trap. We both were affected by the trap, but I shook really good and I avoided falling, but of course, Tobias.
Which still Tobias. Convinces me that, like, you know, instead of having that +4 to your armor class against giants, you have that ability to roll ones over again. Sure, you didn't roll a 1 and you got to roll that over again, but still, it was that aspect of just like...
Weird luck.
And somehow the dice that you roll were there when you were rolling up your character and they were listening. So, I'm convinced of it. So we carry on, though.
After not that many rounds, we were able to put that spider down.
It was definitely there for the shock factor. Yeah. And it was hilarious.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. And then getting into the basement, we realized that we were sort of in a kind of a pantry type kind of place.
There were barrels and stockades of stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know. As the bond between gnomes has increased, there was another opportunity where, like, you know, sure, if you could metagame it, sure, you'd probably be justified to do this too, because it's like Tom and I in our communications non-verbally. But we get down and there's all these barrels of wine and I'm the first one to tap this wine and I taste it and it's really good wine. And so Boddington, you know, in his appreciation for all good things, like, you know, let's say you're a DJ and you find a really good track, you want to play it for other people and share it with other people. So you have this thing that you want to share with other folks and I hand it off to Tara or whoever else and like, this is really good wine and everyone else appreciates the wine too, or at least they realize that it's
good wine
to the point of drinking it and drinking it and drinking it. And suddenly I get in that same sense of like, just that moment of like eye contact where I look to Mako and suddenly like half the party between Tobias and Taro and Magnus, they're all getting wasted off this, it's good wine. Don't get me wrong. And I can appreciate the wine too, but it's like, we are in this delve to do something.
Yeah.
You know, like we have a purpose here. This is the Floating Isles. Let's not lose track of that.
Mm-hmm.
But for whatever reason, they're all just getting wasted.
When it comes to getting drunk in a role-playing game, what's the point?
Yeah.
So, it's a good role-playing experience, but yeah, they were drinking, and it's just like, but we were sort of, it was presented, we were on a crunch of time.
Right. And the crunch of time, and then also, like, I don't want to role-play your character, but would your character really want to be getting drunk right now?
Yeah.
Like, when I'm on the clock, so to speak, or when I'm on a mission, and I have something to do, don't get me wrong, once I get that mission done, I will embrace a shot or a drink or whatever else. Right. But like in the midst of it all right, sure, whatever. It was another opportunity for Violet and I to just kind of look at each other and go, these guys are kind of weird.
Sort of.
I mean, they call us weird, but they're a little messed up.
So, we allowed them to sober up. They apparently sobered up quite quickly.
Enhance that with your prestidigious?
No, I didn't. I can't do it on anyone but myself.
Oh, okay.
Then we went up to the third level. And the third level actually had that weapons rack that was actually picked over, which were all large weapons. But there was indeed a trap on that fourth level.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that third level, right above the other one, right above the other one, and right above the other one.
Yeah. Which is kind of one of these, like, I thought that was, like, fair play to the DM.
Yeah.
Because it's like, if you get to the fourth level and you're like, really? You're not going to check this part of the map right now?
Yeah.
You're going to take that much more falling damage.
Right.
You dipshit.
But we checked it and we made sure. And this level was just actually a hallway that went all the way around the whole perimeter.
Yeah.
It was a big circle that went around. Yeah. Yeah. There were no doors. And I had a potion of detect secret doors. So I used that to scan the walls and we found a secret door. Oh, I did not mention. When we were in the basement, while those guys were messing around drinking, I discovered that that skeleton that had priestly or cleric or wizardly robes, there was a scroll, which was a series of spells that were all numbered from 1 to 9.
Yeah, but that seems rather mundane.
Hmm.
Like when you're in a dungeon delve and you find something on the lower level that's just like 9 spells of randomness.
But they were all numbered 1 through 9.
Yeah, numbered whatever.
Yeah.
Like he must have just been like a fan of like sequence. And that's like maybe his favorite. Who knows? Who cares? Whatever. How is that going to come in handy?
Yeah. But we got to this level and we opened up the secret door, and inside the secret door there was sort of a workshop area with
there was a white table.
Yep.
There were some gem tinkerings.
Yep.
There was a warm sphere.
Yeah.
That was just kind of, I don't know, was it emanating any sort of energy at the time?
Yeah.
Was it kind of just like,
it was magical. It illuminated the whole room with bright light. And of course I touched it. And it gave a lot of fire damage to me, but so I realized it was dangerous.
But I was like this glowing, beaming inside. Just
well,
like,
I touched it with my spear again. Yeah, it was like,
well, still, yeah. I'm just like, yeah,
yeah.
I would totally have done that too, but I'm leaving it to you.
It was great.
That's you swinging from the planar model.
Yeah, yeah. So
metaphorically speaking,
but it was actually Tobias who figured it out that maybe that was.
I think it was Schlegel.
Well, it was Schlegel. It yeah, but let's give it to Tobias because okay. I think every once in a while Tobias comes up with something like, wait a minute, and it's actually his I'm a boss kind of thing comes through.
Right, but we've still never like drawn the line between what is Schlegel and what is Tobias. I'm still convinced that they are one and the same.
Well, I think all of us are one and the same, but but realize that that scroll with the numbered spells was
you actually, mean that key off in the other room that could have connected to some random chest, somewhere else or another.
But you know what? Those are the things that make dungeons great.
Yeah, and we've mentioned it before. That's why I'm being this whole like, what do you mean?
But it was great, you know, and I think I really appreciated the detail that was in this dungeon.
Yeah.
I really enjoy it. I mean, I really enjoy each level instead of just being a mundane room.
There has to be 5 levels because it'll stall them for this much time.
Right.
Who cares what the rooms have in them? It'll just be something to distract them.
But they have detail and purpose. Yeah. Know? And I think that's what really makes a dungeon interesting, or that's what really feels. You have to give them more than just this is a 10 by 10 room.
Yeah.
It has to have some kind of description to it.
And I think for at least this particular delve, even mm-hmm. though it was kind of vertically progressing, it's kind of counterintuitive. We're delving. You think when you're delving into something, you're going deeper, but we're delving upwards.
Yeah.
That we ended last week on the threshold of this. That I think that's the best setup. And I think other DMs would agree, I'm assuming. The best sort of a way to end a session is to be on the threshold of a delve or on something that they're immediately going to go into
mm-hmm.
so that you can put the time you have to prepare for the next session into what they're going to immediately get into.
Yeah.
And that's where I think you and I have seen Wolfie thrive.
Right.
Where it's like, okay, we've just fought out this dragon, but we've expressed in the previous session that we're going to go off into the other tower. The Wolfie can then go, all right, let's make this awesome. Wolfie can't be blamed for lack of effort when he knows where to put the effort.
Right.
And he definitely put the effort in the right place.
Yeah.
And I think it was awesome in this whole session.
Again, you know, it's just like, and I think that's kind of the important thing to think about in role-playing games is like, the game really isn't going up a level. That's kind of like...
It's the journey, not the destination.
Yeah. I mean, you level up because you need to get better at things to fight better monsters to be able to deal with better things. But really the game is playing through dungeons.
Yeah.
The game is playing through encounters.
And we're in the middle of a great dungeon.
So, you know, just enjoy these things.
Yeah.
Relax. But we had to get back to town. So we had to be back in town to make this happen.
So there was a certain rush.
There was inherent a certain rush.
To like be like, let's get this done with. Let's get back to town and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a metagaming motivation.
Right.
Because there's none of us that are in the middle. Nobody should be in the middle of this tower going, no, wait, we need to get back to town because somehow magically we'll get there and we'll get new skills.
Yeah.
If anything, we're here, and this is a place to learn, especially if you're Violet.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're about to come upon this amazing sphere.
Yeah, well, and getting back to that sphere, we used the spells.
Used the spells.
Well, Tobias recognized that these spells could disrupt and destroy this sphere, which was, what was it?
Prismatic sphere?
It was this prismatic sphere.
Yeah. Bringing back to this whole experience where I've had to pick a good number of locks and disable a good number of traps. And every time I have, the party's always scattered. And the one that's always been by my side has been Violet.
Mm-hmm.
As begrudging as it was as a role player to see this opportunity to go, nope, this is where I pay my dues. Because it was this sphere. And whenever, like, I don't know, it's kind of a cliche where it's like you see a sphere as a role player and you're just like, spheres are bad. You know, I don't know if it's like from seeing the Lord of the Rings and just seeing that whole like thing where Saruman has his hand over the thing. And it's just like, a sphere is a badass thing that is more powerful than you could ever hope to be. So whatever you try to do, it'll smoke your ass. So it's more than just a door that you're trying to pick that you have to roll over 20.
Yeah.
So I'm like, it's going to go bad. This is going to be bad news, but nope. Everyone's scattering. I'm going to watch right by Violet's side.
Yep.
You know, kind of like half covering my eyes with my fingers parting, you know, to like kind of like see what's going to happen, but still being afraid of getting burnt up.
So Violet casted her spells in order, and I did really good on those. And I was able to cast spells that were much higher than mine.
Because I think the strategy was there, but also like I would imagine Wolfie would have had part of it being like the dice still have to agree with you. And I'm like, Mako doesn't roll that many dice well.
Yeah. I was able to, and we were able to break down all the layers of the prismatic sphere. We revealed that they had a very large apparatus key type thing was underneath it. So,
what do you mean? Like an actual physical key?
It seemed like it looked like a key. There was a picture that was connected to it. To me, it looked like a key, and it's a key. We're not going to say what it is. Although it was said what it was, it's a key. It was a great picture and I liked it and I thought it was very cool. I'm not going to ruin that. And everyone knows what it, everyone at our camp.
Except for our beloved listeners. What do you mean? What are you talking about?
Well, Well, it's going to ruin it now. Whoopi had found a great picture of
a
very unique apparatus.
Well, they can find out about that.
But
not role playing with us.
But it was a very unique apparatus, and a lot of us didn't know what it was. But there was a few at the table who knew exactly what it was.
No, there was one that, I think the one that did know that decided to go, hey, that wasn't me this time.
Yeah.
Wolfie actually was just like, conk.
Yeah.
On Nicole's head.
Poor Nicole.
Poor Nicole.
You don't mean to tease her much.
You know.
But it was.
She has the enthusiasm there, but it's just like, shush.
You're pretending it's something.
We're playing.
How could you pretend that you were getting drunk in the basement, but you can't pretend that
you can't hold this in. Exactly. But it was one of those, like, apple coring devices where, I don't know if you've seen, where you put the apple core on the end and you crank it and it peels it, but then it also, like...
It's an apple peeler, yeah.
But it's more than an apple peeler. It, like, cores it and it cuts in a spiral shape around it as you crank it.
Yeah, yeah.
Regardless, it looks like an amazing contraption.
Yeah.
And I think everyone recognized what it was.
I didn't know what it was.
Oh, really?
No, I had a clue. I thought it was a saw. I had no idea.
Yeah, well.
But anyways.
It looked exactly honed for the task.
Yeah.
And Wolfie was like, nurr! And to his credit, in preparation, fall 2011, he was over at Schlegel's place, and Jennifer had this out. And he stops over, and he sees this thing, and he secretly takes a picture of it. And that's the picture he showed us. The picture we saw of this divine, crazy contraption was the picture he took more than a year ago in preparation for his campaign.
Well, that's great DMing to be able to say, hey, wait a minute. This is interesting and strange. I'm going to apply to my world. Yeah,
you know, always something, you know, you around the corner and see some billboard that's like, whoa, that could totally be something for something.
Yeah.
And even if you don't know, just,
Well, you know, I'm probably not going to DM for another year. I've been preparing since the moment I stopped because you have to develop it all.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And it will only lend to the evolution of what will be the best thing to present for your players.
Yes.
Because
False statement I ever heard anyone say is you can over prepare. No, that's
not true. For a campaign, no. But for a con or like a one shot, probably.
Maybe.
But if I were to say, okay, Mago, next Sunday, you're going to be the DM for the next Pathfinder campaign next week. You could do it. But given the amount of time between now and whenever you do start, it's always knowing where you are with the understanding of your world, but then also where you are with the understanding of us as players. That I think, you know, that's kind of the symbiosis of the whole endeavor.
After this level, we went up to the next level up. And the next level up was basically just a lot of open rooms with large beds in them and some mundane stuff. But nothing really of any interest on this level. It was just basically describing this was a sleeping quarters.
But then further up.
But then we went up to the roof. And the roof, basically, it was a larger tower, and on top of it, there's a smaller tower. So we were on the top of the larger tower with the smaller tower that extends from that. So we were on basically a rooftop. On the rooftop, there were a lot of pools. There was like one large pool that went around the edge with basically a walkway that approached the smaller tower in the center that had a bunch of different switches, gears, so forth and so on. A definite flow of pictures is showing us all sorts of interesting...
Like post-it notes of sorts.
Well, there were switchboards and gears and everything. And then there were notes all over the apparatus explaining how to turn certain things on and switch things on to make certain things happen. Oh. A little faded, but they were written in common. So Violet was immediately interested in what it was all about, but didn't have much time to think about it. Taro took to the sky to scout and make sure that this top level was safe, and quickly found that it was not.
Yes.
There were these goat-like creatures, and I rolled poorly on my planar roll, so I have no idea what they are.
Knowledge planar.
Knowledge planar, and everyone else did poorly on their knowledges, so we just were not able to figure out what these creatures were.
They were just freaky, horned, white-eyed dudes.
Yep.
That had
halberds with grimy black goo coming off them. Interesting fight.
It was. And I guess to cut to kind of like the unique parts of this, apart from just the whole aspect of it was monstrous and we fought them. Between you and Taro, you both reached for unconventional weapons.
Right. Well, we were cornered to particular things. The creatures had damage reduction, so the arrows were just not doing it. All of Taro's magical arrows,
the cold damage or whatever,
cold damage were not affecting them. The magical elements of them were not affecting these creatures. They were able to fling the electrical currents away. The cold damage just sort of dissolved.
And even with your lightning spell.
Yep, and it just reflected it. You were able to acrobat your way out because we got cornered pretty quickly.
Yeah.
No, what I tried doing is I tried turning invisible, and they were able to figure out exactly where I was.
Yeah, because this hasn't been the first time you've been little gnome lost trying to make yourself invisible that any self-respecting DM would be like, you know what? I'm going to make a combat for this next session, and I'm going to find out a way to make sure that that invisibility isn't invincible.
Yeah. Saying that the visibility wasn't going to work and all these things, she looked at the spear that was in her hand, her new magical spear, and it's like, well, apparently I got to use this.
Yeah.
So she stuck the goat-type creature that was beside her, and I think I shocked Boddington.
And everyone else, for that matter.
And Taro dropped his crossbow and charged in with the sword.
Yep.
Recognized as like, I can't do anything with this crossbow. I'm going in with my sword. And so the two of us are doing things that we don't usually do.
Yeah.
Melee combat.
I thought it was entertaining as a player, and I'm sure as Wolfie as a DM, he had to have been like, yes, I'm getting them to like work outside their comfort zone.
Well, I was really hoping that I could get through this whole entire campaign without ever having
to use a physical weapon.
Violet was never going to use a physical weapon.
Yeah.
But it turned out pretty great all the same. I think it's pretty cute that she had to finally use her spear at eighth level.
But it was a badass spear.
Right,
it wasn't your first level spear that you're just like, oh, it's a stick that I've been holding on to for six months.
The only thing that would have made it even better is if she would have shook a 20. I shook a 19.
Yeah.
Well, but I didn't shake a 20.
Too bad it wasn't a keen.
I know.
But how many times you need a party to have a keen weapon? Once, especially when it's in the hand of a fighter that rolls 20s all the fucking time.
Yeah, exactly. So they summoned. Remember, we eliminated the first wave.
Yeah.
And one of them stepped back and summoned more goat creatures to attack us. Definitely they were from a different plane. And, you know, and it was funny because I thought about it later, but I had to protect. I have like 3 protection from evil potions. Oops.
But, you know, kind of like we were talking about earlier, where we kind of failed to recognize the potency of protection from evil when we were fighting that big crazy demon thing that laughed really loud. There's a definite planar theme going on in this campaign so far. And now that we're at these floating isles, it's still kind of there echoing in the background, and there is still no shortage of summoned creatures. But, you know, we can't fully invest in this protection from evil spell to be our anything that comes from another plane, anything that comes summoned our way, we'll just cast the spell and we'll be fine. I mean, sure, we've messed up in the past every so often to, you know, not acknowledge its protection properties or be able to like realize that, oh, I could do this and we'll be protected. The more we would, the more it would motivate our DM to like come up with the next thing to make us vulnerable.
This is true.
Because there's no shortage of things in the bestiary. You know what I mean?
You know, I mean, you could have it. They can dispel magic.
It's fun to be able to, like, give into that vulnerability.
Yeah.
Whether it's our mistake, the DM's mistake, or...
And, you know, and I think that's the whole thing is you got to be, as a DM, that's the thing to be on your feet for. If people are overusing a particular system or overusing a particular thing.
A mechanic,
you know, and they walk boldly in with a confidence of a particular mechanic to be able to go, it's like, well, it doesn't work this time. And they're like, whoa, why? And it's just like, well, you didn't think of this.
Yeah. But it requires that kind of preemptive thinking. It's not like you as a DM are here in this place right now, you've prepared this thing, and your player has a spell that would counter it, and then you're going, or you're in the back of your mind going, I don't want them to counter it, so I will make up something that I'm like, no, it doesn't work this time.
No.
Why? Because I'm the DM.
Right,
it's like you have to kind of like recognize that trend, whether it's Violet using invisibility spells too much, or whether it's Boddington using bombs too much, or whether it's Magnus using melee attacks too much, or whatever it is. It's like, you need to recognize a trend to kind of go, all right, you're using this and it's working. Awesome. Way to go. That's your strength. You're doing great. And then have it happen again. Maybe a third time. But then all of a sudden the fourth time, they're like, yeah, I'm doing that thing. And then all of a sudden, but this happens.
Well,
for a predetermined reason, for a pre-planned reason.
Right.
It's not like you're just throwing a DM douchebag curve on
right.
them.
It's
like, this is part of what makes them the monster that you're fighting.
Well, I think the thing too is so you're not making it boring for them. You know, it's like if we can just always be able to bypass everything because we are drinking protection from evil spells, it's going to get boring for us after a while. It's like, well, we know how to avoid this. We know how to avoid that.
Oh, look, I made alchemical extract, and we have two protection from evil potions. These things will last us for at least two delves in every monster we come upon. And it's like, all right, great. Adventuring is awesome. I don't know why other people aren't capitalizing on this. Because it's really not that hard.
Yeah. Just go get protection from evil spells.
Just get this potion, go into this crazy place. And sure, it's kind of like eerie and creepy, but like, make sure you do it within so many rounds and you're good.
Yeah.
Don't worry.
So,
paper, rock, scissors.
So, I mean, but it is true. It's like you don't, I wasn't putting it out there that the DM is just a douchebag and make sure that anything that they come up with, they cuts it down just because he wants his monsters to win. But it just said make it that, okay, there's a variety of different things. It's for Violet to be seen when she's invisible, it pushed her to a new world. You know, it's like, oh shit.
A DM is a participant in patient evolution.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with getting duped 2, 3, 4 times as a DM. Going, oh my gosh, this character did invisibility and my monster couldn't do anything to her. And then she did invisibility again. And I couldn't do anything to her again. And once you get to that point where it's like you realize as a DM where it's like it's time for that thing to wear out. That player has to come up with a new trick.
Well, but and the whole thing too is just that there are different elements to that invisibility spell that sometimes it's not going to work. Sometimes mm-hmm. it will. It was always still going to be in my arsenal of
yeah.
things that definitely Violet likes to do.
You will never give up that spell, but still there are monsters that have like scent
mm-hmm.
or the tremor sense
right.
or anything else that, you know, give them a chance to go, okay, you're invisible, but this is a monster that doesn't have eyes.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to hone in on that one particular part of invisibility, but
or,
still.
Or just cast See Invisible.
Yeah. Right,
which is one of the
or spells. True Seeing.
True Seeing. True yeah. Seeing, exactly. Or Glitter Dust, which I also have.
Yeah. Well, that was way back when you had that one.
Yeah. So after we disposed of them finally, which it was great because it was a great challenge because spells weren't working at that well and sort of, and we had to get into melee and so forth. So
yeah,
I mean,
you had to go to resources that weren't comfortable for yeah. you guys, but you still had to have faith in them.
We gathered it all together and we started to figure out these notes and everything. And we actually were able to figure out how to operate
the control island. Center.
Because this island is basically its own individual ship, and it has eight different
functions. Plane shift, encompassing the whole island. Number 2, protective sphere. Number 3, propel. Number 4, and I'll just go through the rest of them, invisibility, etherealness, channel, beam, time shift, and then the last one, stasis.
Now, time shift was the one that really piqued up Violet's interest because when we were on this top level, we also discovered a flag. And the flag was the crest of the Lukobar family. And so,
In other words, the princess.
The princess.
Family that yeah. was kidnapped.
So the princess actually put these notes up here and was able to discover this much. So
do we know anything about what the princess was as far as like any sort of vague implication of class? Was she
no.
a wizard or a sorcerer or an alchemist?
Well, if she was a wizard, she could have grabbed that scroll and used it on the prismatic spear to get the key.
But you did roll really well. Maybe she just rolled really shitty.
I don't know.
But regardless, I'm more your follower than ever before. So for you seeing this symbol and seeing how this whole event came to a climax of leading into this Kobar element, that it's like, all right, if you want to find her, I'm by
your
side.
And the thing is what Violet wants to do is go back in time and get her right before she is sold off to the Lich and into the world.
Via the Githyanki.
Yeah. So even if maybe we get between that whole selling where the Githyanki and the Lich are selling her, maybe right at that point to be able to step in.
But do you know when that happened? Did that happen before we were fourth level, third level?
No, it happened the last time those islands came through.
So if you succeeded doing that,
Well, hell will be fucked up, but not our world. Because I'm not going to bring her back to the past. I'm going to bring her back to our time.
Well, is time consistent between planes?
Violet thinks so. Well, that's all that matters, Violet.
Something as powerful as time shift is almost just like that wish spell where it's like the DM's like, you had a certain ambiguity in this phrase, and you want to go with this time shift spell to go back to save this person.
Have you ever known Violet to really concern herself with the details?
No, but have you ever known a DM to not take advantage of the ambiguity of
I know, but Violet, as far as she knows, is everything's going to be fine. This is going to work out perfectly.
Don't get me wrong, that would be hilarious if all of a sudden, you know, Wolfie was like, all right, you all time shift back to rescue this princess. Magnus and Boddington, you're back. And Boddington, you just realized that you might enjoy brewing beers. You are a zero-level civilian.
Well, no. If we're on this island, we will time shift back. We're gonna time shift back 1,000 years.
Exactly.
Well, we're not going to turn into embryos.
No, we're going to turn into whatever the DM says.
Well, we're not. It's not us time shifting.
It's time shifting.
But we're inside a protective sphere.
We get to, like, go back in time and, like, mess with stuff and then come back?
Yeah.
Really?
I think so.
Violet? You know what you're talking about.
So
I'll stand by your side.
With a great enthusiasm and excitement, Violet knows exactly what she wants out of these islands. We're going to save the princess. For some reason, Violet is very concerned about this princess. She's decided this princess is something to be concerned about. And also, this princess is most likely going to be her best buddy, along with the dragon. And that one...
Can I be your third best buddy?
Well, you're my best buddy of all. Well, you're a gnome. You're not even a buddy... You're a comrade?
Buddies are outside of our gnomish connection. I was recently, I don't know, I suppose before we sign off, you're like, God damn it, guys, get to the end. We're at the end. Yeah. But I just wanted to get to this last topic of you're here, you're listening to an RPG podcast. I'm assuming you're a nerd on some sort of a level. And the level I'm referring to right now is anime, and I was rewatching Ninja Scroll.
Well, it's between the two characters.
Yeah, becomes a point between Jubei and Kagero, the ninja and the ninja girl, where Kagero asks, why did you risk yourself to save me? You put yourself on the line, and you could have died. Why did you come and save me? And Jubei's response is, well, we're comrades. You know, I've seen the movie 1,000 times, and just coming back to watch it again, it's just like, that's totally Boddington and Violet right there. Every role-playing group is a party, and we're all just connected, and we're allies, and we're friends. But just that term between Kagero and Jubei was kind of like, that's what Boddington and Violet are. They're just comrades.
But also, on our way back to town, we came across two elves in the water that were half-drowned trying to swim back to shore. And we brought them onto the ship. And so Violet has given herself the realization that these are also going to be her buddies as well. Anyone who is an outsider, strange, and doesn't really belong, Violet wants to make them her friends. If they hate her, it's even better. I'm going to make that dragon my best friend somehow.
Especially because the more I kind of like look at your nonsense, the more I'm like, I can kind of see you having Gnome Town. And then whenever somebody attacks Gnome Town, you have a black dragon that is now fully grown, smoking the shit out of any invader.
You think, yeah, of course, Violet thought of that.
You know what I mean? It's just like, you know what? You took my shit, but you didn't kill me. But I come back and I try to kill. I don't know if this will, you know, pan out later on, but it's just like, you know what? I like the way you think. We're comrades. We're comrades. So, comrade.
Well,
until next time, we've talked long enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Number 23.
Yeah.
I'm Jake.
And I'm Mako.
And this has been RPG Afterglow.
Awesome.